Welcome to the fifth floor of the Tower of the Jewish Theological Seminary.
Fourth floor.
Yeah, that's right. We came down from the fifth floor. I don't even know where I am. Welcome to the fourth floor. My name is David Kramer. I am the director of the library here at JTS. And we have had the privilege over the course of a number of years now to sponsor book talks of a variety of sorts. We are, of course, the book center of the seminary, and we take great pleasure both in the publications of our faculty. That's the way these programs began. And then in just having the privilege and opportunity to bring attention, greater attention to the seminary community and beyond, to important books in the Jewish world. And tonight is one such event. We are co-sponsoring this event with the Finkelstein Institute. And so I'd like to introduce Dr. Bert Posatsky to introduce our speaker.
Thank you. I want to actually recognize and thank my colleague Michal Rauscher, who first called my attention to this remarkable book that we're going to hear about tonight. Joy Layton is the David and Ruth Gottesman Professor of English. We have to say that right because they paid good money for that name at Stern College of Yeshiva University, and she is the first openly transgender employee of an Orthodox Jewish institution. She is a Fulbright scholar and author of 7 books, including Psalms and Coming to Life, which was named one of the most 5 most important Jewish poetry books in the year 2010 by the Foreword. I just want to say, with her connivance, we have 3 copies for first come, first serve of the Joy cover of Lilith which is a great thing. And at the end of Joy's talk, she will be signing books for you. We're selling at discount, $20 each, and we have a number of copies. In 2012, she was named to the Foreword 50, and having read this book, really teary-eyed, I have to say, that Joy writes with an honesty and a clarity that makes her trans experience speak to the most profound moments of the human condition: love, marriage, sexual identity, divorce, and parenting. As you will experience tonight, Joy Layton is a voice of singular courage, and she's speaking to us about Through the Door of Life, a Jewish Journey Between Genders. Thank you.
Thank you so much. It's really, really great to be here. And, you know, this voice of singular courage is feeling quite scared. I want to talk not... I don't want to, like, sort of talk through the life story that I discuss in my book, because I actually wrote the book because I thought it was an interesting... that my story was a way of thinking about more interesting issues of becoming an identity. And as I've been doing this very strange tour, like the trans tour of the Jewish world, like Trans-Jew Airlines is flying me around, I've become really aware that I'm privileged in many communities. I'm invited to the community because the community is ready to think about how Judaism can relate to, accommodate, deal with transgender identity and transgender Jews. And it's a privilege to be at communities, really, that are in a moment of becoming, because this is stuff that's new for all of us. I mean, I haven't gone anywhere, and I've gone to a lot of places at this point, where people are not still trying to figure out what words to use, what customs to adopt, how to make sense of things. When I transitioned, and as I talk about this in the book, it's a pretty isolated story. I didn't have a public identity. In fact, I was... my girlfriend is telling me to speak louder. So I didn't have a public identity. In fact, I was giving up my identity, the one public identity I had as a man, and I was kind of nobody. Then when I came back to teach at Stern, thanks to the New York Post, I suddenly became the signpost at the corner of Judaism and transsexuality. And so I wanted to talk about some of the issues that that I've seen coming up at that intersection as I've moved through the world and as I've reflected on my own experience. One thing that people have often asked me is, how is it possible that I teach at an Orthodox Jewish university? Right? I'm kind of like a Zen koan. This is clearly impossible. And in fact, I think it is impossible. I really don't know. I think in the prosaic sense, it's some combination of, the rules of tenure and the New York City human rights law that includes gender identity. But there's something else, because even with all the legal protections in the world, when a place doesn't want you because you're too other, they have ways of getting rid of you, or making it too uncomfortable for you to live there. And I've never been made uncomfortable since I've come back. And I think that that's truly a miracle. And the students who have talked to me, and I don't get to ask my students, which I'd like to. I'd like to actually ask every single student, number one, do you know that I used to live as a man? Okay, if you do, what the heck are you doing in my class? Like, how can you do that? But this is a very bad pedagogical practice, so I don't. So I have to rely on the students who talk to me about it. And particularly at the beginning, when I was dealing with students who knew me as a guy, so I went away. I went on involuntary research leave. I was put on this. And I wasn't allowed for a semester to talk to anybody about why I was gone. So at first, everybody thought that either I or one of my family members had, some serious illness. And so they did what they do at Stern, which is they pray. But the people gradually began to find out that that I was not there because I was trans. And many of them were pretty angry about it, which was strange. I mean, some of them were angry at me because, like, why did you present yourself as a guy and give us the idea that we might marry a man who would be interested in talking about our ideas about literature if you were actually going to then transition? But they were more angry at the institution, and they were angry at it as Jews, as Orthodox Jews. They felt like this is not the way Orthodox Jews treat human beings. And what they said is they feel that their understanding of Judaism is that whatever was going on with me, and none of them really had a clue about transsexuality or transgender identity, but I was a human being, and that meant that I was made in the image of God, and that meant that the way that I was treated was a mark of how Orthodox Jews in Judaism were treating God, the image of God. And I've never ceased to be astonished and grateful and also really challenged by that. I mean, that's what I want Judaism to be about. You know, if you have to boil it down to one thing, that is not a bad thing to boil it down to. And it's a lesson that I try to learn from myself. But what my students' acceptance of me gets around is the fact that if you go back to the chapter in Genesis where we hear about B'Tselem Elohim, the announcement that human beings are created in the image of God, whatever that means, is immediately linked to the gender binary. Male and female, God created them. So there's kind of a paradox here, and it's a paradox that I think is built into Judaism, and it's a paradox that the emergence of transgender Jews and our desire to be seen as part of the Jewish community for who we are requires all of us to kind of wrestle with and think about. When I read that section of the Torah, I'm very, I have no problem thinking, who wrote the Torah, but even thinking that this is dictated to Moses by God, I have no problems thinking that God is anxious. So I see this as a moment of anxiety. Like, what is actually the relationship between the human being and the divine? There can't be a Judaism if there's no relationship. And this is the moment in the Torah where that relationship is going to be explained, and it's explained through this abstraction, the image of God. But human beings don't have just one image. So immediately, I feel that there's this explanation that links the image of God to the physical nature of human beings, and that's where the gender binary comes up. When I was growing up, I didn't have a really theoretical relation to that, but I had a, a deeply personal struggle with this, because I also, we were talking about this at dinner, I also understood human beings to be created male and female. Those were the categories. I didn't grow up in a religious family, but those were the categories that my society gave. All human beings are either male or female, and I knew that I wasn't either one of them. So I didn't really know what to do with that. It seemed, you know, I told myself different things. Sometimes I said, you know, I was a boy who felt like a girl. Sometimes I said I was a girl in a boy's body. I could say all of these different things, but the truth is that gender binary really didn't fit to describe my experience of myself. And so I became pretty sure that I wasn't actually human, because the terms of my culture that defined what a human being was didn't fit me. I couldn't locate myself within them. And if I had been a better reader of the Torah — I did read the Torah, but I kind of skipped over that part — then I would have also wondered whether the fact that I wasn't human meant that maybe I wasn't created in the image of God. But I didn't actually wonder about that, because one of the things that I found when I talked to trans people is it's very common for us to have extremely intense relationships with God when we are children, and sometimes for the rest of our lives, but often when we're children. And I did also. I think there are a number of reasons for that. One is that because if you think about spiritual disciplines, they're all about trying to get human beings to let go of our attachment to ourselves and our identities. Because when you stand in real relation to God, all that stuff just gets blown away. However, if you're trans, you don't have much of a relationship to yourself or your identity. I mean, I knew that my identity was that of a fake boy. And so I think trans children often don't have as much identity to let go of. And so there was a way in which God was just a physical experience for me. God seemed quite real. And in fact, we would often discuss, because we talked all the time, God seemed more real than I did. I was quite sure God existed, but I had serious doubts about whether I did. So I'm having this, you know, quite intense relationship with God. And part of that was I knew, in a way that other people didn't seem to, that I was a created being. I felt — somebody asked me about what I say about beating. Did I feel like I was this reflected, that I was creating my identity by hand? And I think I was creating my identity by hand, but because I wasn't the usual thing, because I didn't fit anywhere, I felt like, yeah, I must have been created by God. Like, I was handmade. Maybe God had an assembly line for everybody else, but clearly I was, you know, a hobby done on the side. And so, on the one hand, I feel not human, I don't exist, I'm less than human. On the other hand, I have an intense relationship with God. And that predated any understanding of Judaism. But when, because of being bored in synagogue — I know nobody here can relate to that experience, but I was in synagogue, desperate for something to read that was not a prayer. And the only thing was the Torah. And so I started reading the Torah, and I was really captivated by it. And what I noticed was that the Torah is all about relationships, and it's all about relationship with God. And it's all about God's difficulty in relating to human beings. And I'm like, yes, right on. It's really hard, isn't it? It's really hard when you don't have a body to get people to see you. It's really hard to to get people to recognize you for who you are. In fact, you may feel like no matter what you do, people look right through you or right past you or misrecognize you or say, you know, yeah, we'd prefer the golden calf version of the little boy that we've named Jay to seeing the you that you are. Because the thing about God is not just that the God in the Torah doesn't fit into this or that image. It's that the God in the Torah doesn't fit into any human categories. God is beyond time and space. God is beyond the human conceptions of justice. And I was not beyond time and space and beyond justice, but I didn't feel like I fit into this human category of gender. So when I read the Torah, I felt like I was reading the charter for my religion. Like I was really a Jew in this kind of radical way. And one of the JTS graduate, Jill Hammer, I was talking with about this. We didn't put this blurb on the book. She was very generous, but she said, oh, you are a feral Jew. And I thought, yes, that's me. I was a feral Jew. I was like a Jew raised by wolves, and all I had was I had wolves, and I had the Torah. And out of that, I constructed this idea of Judaism. What I really had was a Judaism without Jews. Because my Judaism was based on God. I had this relationship with God, and I had a book that was all about the relationship with God. And those were the fundamental realities for me. And anything that anybody said was Judaism or Jewish that got in the way of that, I was not interested in. Because that was like the gender stuff. It just didn't fit me. It wasn't applicable. So what ended up happening was I made a covenant with God that went something like, I'll believe in you if you believe in me. Or, I will be true to the reality of you because you seem to be stringing me along with the reality of me, something more like that. And I'm not going to let anybody tell me anything that interferes with that. So I wasn't in a religious family, so I wasn't growing into a version of Judaism that was reinforced by social structures and an authority structure. Really, I was free to interpret the Torah in any way that I wanted to, and I did. I was like, oh, yeah, sacrifice stuff, yeah, that's not me. Forget it, that's not important to you either, I know, because, right, we're bored when we read that. You know, so I know your jobs would all be easier if you could do this. But this is the feral Jew thing. But it reflected, so I came out with this kind of maimed covenant. I had a very strong covenant with God, but I had no covenant at all with the Jewish people. And the nature of the full covenant is that you have a covenant with both. And the record of the Torah is that those covenants are in tension. You know, it's clear that Moses would have a much easier life if he could just hang out with God. But he can't do that. And even when God offers it to him, can you imagine how tempted he was? Let me just wipe them all out, and we'll start with you. He's like, no, can't let that go. So if you're really a Jew, you have to hold those two conflicting covenants. And they are conflicting, because the relationship with being Jewish is a social relationship. And the categories of human society are categories in which God is really not visible. God doesn't fit in human categories. And the covenant with God is a covenant to not just be bound by those human categories, to always see beyond them and have a divine experience beyond them. And somehow, our job as Jews is to marry the two together. But I didn't do it. I mean, I didn't make that. And when I read, and I love that part, when, you know, Pharaoh says to Moses, okay, you can go sacrifice in the wilderness. By the way, who's going? And Moses gives that wonderful rendition of, we'll go with our old and with our young and with our sons and with our daughters. But if you're reading that and you're a person like me, you're like, oh yeah, we're leaving out our trans people. I didn't know there was such a thing as a trans person, but I could see that when you're naming the totality of the Jewish people, you have this gender binary that's built into it. So I really couldn't, as I saw it, fit into the Jewish people, into the Jewish community, because it was structured, it was constituted in terms of the gender binary. Because it was a human community, and because of all of the laws and rules and norms that were built on that gender binary. So we'll go with our sons and daughters, was saying, and we're not going to go with you. And I'm like, that's okay, because God and I are hanging out. But it also wasn't okay. It meant that whatever I did as a Jew, I felt like I was also a stranger, you know, or this great phrase. I remember how delighted I was. My mother was Canadian, and I was a Star Trek fan, and one of the high points of my childhood was finding out that she was a resident alien. And I was like, yeah, the government knows about my mother too. But I was kind of a resident alien. You know, I was in the Jewish world. I was supposed to be Jewish, but I really was other. And I think that experience, number one, I think is really common to transgender Jews. I think it's common to a lot of other people in the Jewish community also, and that's one of the things that I think that the Jewish world gets out of wrestling with issues of transgender inclusion, is that these issues actually are pretty widely applicable. There are a lot of people who don't fit the customary categories of Jewish identity who nonetheless are here and want to be part of things. So transgender people, pretty small group of people, but if you think about all the people who have kind of a complicated relationship to the Jewish world, it ends up being quite a few. But I'm going to focus on the kind of strangeness that I know. So my Stern students, they're leaping all over that. They're saying, no, you're not a stranger. We're not even worried about what kind of a Jew you are. I mean, they're already like, you're Orthodox or we can't categorize you. But we know, we see to your essence, and we see that the image of God is in you. But that was not my relationship. I was not ready to go to anybody else and say, I belong here, wherever here is, because I'm made in the image of God. Deal with it. Instead, I felt like a stranger. And I think that the reality, as I go through the Jewish world, I think the reality is that most trans people feel more or less like strangers. And really, there's a big difference between more or less. There are Jewish communities that are actively hostile, where if you are recognized as trans, you are in danger of humiliation, shunning, exclusion, a private word from the rabbi about how you're making people uncomfortable, being directed to another bathroom or another side, right? There are all kinds of things that can happen to you. There are Jewish communities where you're tolerated. You can kind of live at the edge of the camp. You'll come and go. Nobody's going to say anything to you. In fact, you're not even going to be sure if people see you. People are kind of looking right through you, and that's better than the other thing. That's a stage. There are places where trans people are accepted. Like, we know that we have trans members. We mention them. We're self-conscious when we say the men and the women of our congregation. Oh, and the people who don't identify as men or women, right? We'll throw in things like that. But that still requires an act of consciousness. That's still like there's a them that we are trying to accept, right? So that's another stage. And I'm on the board of Keshet, which is working toward, you know, the utopian goal of full inclusion of LGBTQ Jews. And I'm not sure anybody knows what full inclusion actually looks like when it comes to trans people. So that's part of what I'm trying to imagine. And when I was a kid, I was trying to imagine, how do I connect? So I know I have the Torah in common with the Jewish people, but I also know that I'm a stranger. And I know that the reality is that in a lot of places I talk, people are very nice, but they see me as strange. And frankly, my kids see me as strange also. I saw my mother as strange, but that's a different issue. She wasn't trans. Right? So the Torah, though, so if you are a traditional Jew, if you're a Jew who's concerned with whether you're a halachic Jew or not quite halachic Jew, but you relate your Jewish identity or your Jewish practice is rooted in proximity to transition, what do you do with a strange person like me, who's a Jew but who doesn't fit into any of the normal categories because they're all based on gender? If you say sons and daughters, it's not going to include me. Well, one of the places that you can look is the verse in the Torah that says, "Do not oppress a stranger, for you know the heart of a stranger, for you were strangers in the land of Egypt." So if I'm a stranger, the Torah says, you're obligated to know me. Well, you're obligated not to oppress me. And you can't not oppress me unless you know what my perspective is. And I think that's part of the genius of that verse. You have to be able to imagine how I experience your community. Otherwise, you might be oppressing me and you won't even know it. So you need to do that. You need to know my heart. But how can you know my heart? Because it's the heart of a stranger. It's the heart of someone that you aren't. Right? And I'm not you. If you grew up normally gendered, I'm strange. You can't know my experience. And I can't know yours, by the way. It's a different issue. But so the Torah says you can know the heart of a stranger by reaching to the part of collective Jewish experience where being a Jew meant being a stranger. That was a collective identity. Now, I don't remember Egypt, and the Torah doesn't really tell us very much about Egypt. But you don't have to go very far back in Jewish history to know that, to remember times and places where the world was divided into Jews and Christians, and being a Jew meant that you were weird, right? The society, the world, was a Christian world. If you stepped outside your ghetto, you were marked. You looked strange. Everybody knew you were a Jew. In fact, few people would see anything other than that you were a Jew because you looked so strange. Actually, welcome to my world. That's the world of transgender people in a world where everybody's supposed to be male or female. And you step out of your ghetto, you step out of your apartment to get milk. You go to synagogue on Friday night and you look weird. You don't look male and you don't look female, and so you are marked as other. You're the stranger. And it's hard for people, it's hard for me. When I see people who look strange, it's hard for me to know their hearts. But as I say, Jews really have a lot of experience of being looked at that way. But we have another experience also, which I think brings us even closer to transgender experience. Once Napoleon did us the favor of unlocking the ghettos, so within the ghettos we have an all-Jewish world, and so we don't have to feel like we're strangers. We're the norm. That only comes up outside the ghetto. But once the ghettos are unlocked, then you have many Jews, and I think that would include most people in this room, where being Jewish is a constructed identity. It's a series of choices and calculations and relationships. So I was at a Reform congregation, and I said, you know, probably for most people in this room, if you say you're Jewish, that's really the beginning of a 15-minute explanation. Well, I was born Jewish, but my mother wasn't Jewish. So halachically, I wasn't Jewish. However, I was raised Jewish. And then I had an Orthodox conversion, but I'm not Orthodox. However, I've become observant. But I insist on egalitarian, right? Right? So it's on and on and on. It's like, but you're Jewish, right? Can we just get back to that word? Right? So, but this is what transgender identity is like. Because once you don't have an identity that's fixed by these binaries, once you're not just a man or a woman, once you're just not just a Jew and all Jews are the same, or not a Jew and all non-Jews are the same, then identity actually becomes this series of calculations and relationships in past and present. I used to live as a man. Now I live as a woman. My relationship to my trans identity has really been changed by becoming public. That's a very different relation to identity than when I go shopping in the supermarket and I really don't want to be seen as trans. But I am still trans, right? So in that way, there's a lot about Jews, you know, non-trans Jews' experience of Jewish identity that enables us to know the heart of the stranger, the transgender stranger who's in our midst. And the Torah commands us to do it. It's one sentence, but it's a lot of work. And if we don't do that work, then we can't be sure that we're not oppressing the stranger. And I would go further and I would say, yeah, we can be pretty sure we're oppressing the stranger. Right? Because if you're not aware of how somebody feels, you can be pretty sure you're going to step on their toes. That's the way human beings work. But the Torah goes beyond the commandment not to oppress a stranger. It also says in another place, and being the Torah, it doesn't make the connection to tell us how these things relate, it says, justice shall you pursue. And it's a little unclear what the pursuit of justice means in terms of transgender Jews. Does that mean that the Satmar Hasidim, because of course they're committed to clinging to the Torah and making it literal, that they have to pursue justice by changing halakha to make it comfortable for trans Satmar Hasidim? Does it mean something else? I mean, what does it mean? This is a question that I think in the secular world, where identities are often framed in political terms, we're used to asking that question. So somebody says, I'm a minority, and immediately we say, oh, okay, so what rights don't you have, and how do we need to refer to you, right? We've done this with a number of different groups. We're still, managing to oppress them, but at least we know what the dance looks like. But I'm not sure that we know how to do this as a Jewish and a religious community. And it's pretty radical questions, because the truth is that halakha is built on the male and female, God created them, model of gender. And if we just sort of tinker with it at the edges, then we'll be creating a space that's somewhere between toleration and acceptance. But if you're fully including people, if that's what pursuing justice means, if pursuing justice means that you're making whole all of the people in your community, then we're going to have to do a lot more. We're going to have to ask ourselves, how does Jewish tradition and practice look through the eyes of these very strange Jews? Because we are going to insist that they are Jews, that however strange Judaism looks to them and however much accommodation we have to make, we're not going to see that as a radical break with Judaism. We're going to see that as what we are commanded to do, that the Torah is, by saying, this is one of the traditional commentaries, it says, justice, justice you shall pursue, because you'll never catch it. Justice is an ongoing process of human beings saying, oh, we really messed up, didn't we? And then trying to adjust things for it. So that, I think, is built into the tradition. But that doesn't make it easy for people whose Judaism is defined by relation to tradition to figure out what to do with people like me. You can do the radical thing of my students and just say, well, you're a human being, you're created in the image of God. But they can do that because I'm not part of their Jewish community. They didn't have to work this stuff out. And I'm grateful that they do that, and I think it's admirable. But other Jewish communities that want me to be fully included, to feel like, yes, I'm really a Jew. It's not just that I have a covenant with God. I have a covenant with the Jewish people. The Jewish people have my back. They're not leaving me behind in the land of Egypt. Moses, the next time, is going to say, we're going with our sons, our daughters, and with those who don't identify clearly with either gender. That's a whole different story. And it's a story that I think is going to take a lot of talking and thinking. And I think it's something that we need to do among ourselves. We need to do it family by family. We need to do it community by community and show by show. And I think that we need to do it not in a coercive way that assumes that there's some kind of utopian model, and anybody who doesn't, what? You don't fully include transgender Jews? What is wrong with you? You suck. There is no utopian model. I haven't visited it yet. If you told me to create a Judaism that was the utopian version, I wouldn't know what to do. It's something we have to do together, and it's going to take time and patience and a lot of dialogue and listening and trial and error. We're going to have to keep knowing the heart of the stranger and checking in with the heart of the stranger in order to do it right. I was with a group of trans Jews, and we'd done this, it was at a queer synagogue, and we had done the thing with the non-trans people, and then they left. And so I said, okay, so let's do a little experiment. If we could right now change Judaism any way we wanted to, would we just chuck out the gender stuff? And amazingly, it was a small group, so it's not representative, but they said no. They said, actually, there's so much that's really beautiful about the gender-organized customs of Judaism. We don't want to let go of that, even though we don't really know how we fit into that and relate to that. Right? At the dinner I was just at, there's going to be a women's seder. Do I think there shouldn't be women's seders? I don't know. Seems like a good thing. Right? But really, I don't know where we go with this. And so that justice, justice you shall pursue, I don't feel we should pursue it with a utopian rage, which is to say that we believe there's some kind of perfect model and that anybody who isn't in any community that isn't right there all the time is somehow failing and sinning. I think that we need to try, but I do hope that more and more Jewish communities will say that me, I'm really a member of the Jewish people, and the Jewish people is really going to do the hard work of figuring out how to fully include me. That is going to be a covenant that works in both directions. You know, I committed, made my covenant with God because I felt God had committed to me. And more I'm feeling that the Jewish people is making that covenant also. What time do we have?
It's about 10 after.
That's not helping me. How much more time in the 40 minutes?
How much time do
you
need before?
Okay. I'd like to talk a little bit longer, but I do want to leave time for questions, if that's okay.
Take a few more minutes, and then we'll open
Okay. So the last thing I wanted to add to this is in the Parshot related to the building of Mishkan, there's this beautiful stuff about giving. And one of the things that I feel is that I don't just want to be tolerated as a Jew, and I don't just want to be accepted, and I'm not even sure I just want to be included. I feel like I want to help build the Mishkan. And when the Torah, you know, when God says, take an offering from everyone whose heart moves them, I feel like that is a commandment to the community, to accept the offerings of people like me. However strange those offerings might be. Really? We got to put something like this in the Mishkan? How do we fit that in, right? That's going to change everything. But that's what the commandment is. Everyone whose heart moves them, you have to take that. And what do I want to give the Jewish people? Well, I'd like to give that experience of God. Because I've discovered that I've done a little bit of stuff with Torah study, teaching Christians to do Torah study. And I've discovered that's wonderful. Like, they've never actually read the Torah. They're like, we can read it? We can interpret it? Like, yes! Like, this is great! I mean, they become Torah addicts right before my eyes. It's beautiful to see. So, what I found is that Jews are really, really great at talking about text, but most of us are not great at talking about God. And Christians are really great at talking about God and really lousy at talking about text. But as a trans Jew, I have a really intense experience of God that is much more normative in many Christian worlds. Like, it's in evangelical Christian communities, you're supposed to talk to God all the time. God's supposed to talk to you. That's normal. That's not like, please, you know, get psychiatric care and have your meds adjusted. People don't back away from you when you talk this way. That's a normal part of the community. And as I say, that was a normal part for me because I felt like I was this stranger and the only person I had to talk to who really knew who I was God. And that's something that I think many trans Jews can begin, can offer to the Jewish community. I also think that the Torah looks different when you read it from a trans perspective. And I think it looks pretty darn good. And one of the problems that you have when you read the same book for 3,000 years is it's hard to read it with fresh eyes. So maybe it's good that we have this whole other group of eyes that read this in new ways. When I read the Torah, I see that it's about becoming all the time. It's constantly about people not having fixed identities. And there was a talk wrote for there was a trans gathering, Jewish trans gathering in Berkeley a few months ago. The hurricane made it impossible for me to get there, but I wrote a Devar Torah, and the point of the Devar Torah was that when I read the stories of Abraham, Sarah, and Isaac, to me they look like they have what I would call transgendered hearts. Now, this is a no-no. We don't use transgendered as a verb. You know, it's supposed to be an adjective. It's like African-American, transgender, Hispanic. But actually, I think that there are people who are not transgender people who have transgender experiences and who become transgendered. And I think, strangely enough, our patriarchs are seriously transgendered. And so I just wanted to offer a little bit of that and then be quiet. So if you look at Abraham, he's this very, very successful man in all of the Bronze Age categories. He's rich, he's powerful and everything. And then he starts talking to God, and God tells him to cut off part of his penis. And that is, like, not what Bronze Age men of his time did. And he had to have genital surgery in order to come into his full Jewish identity. So in my world, wow, genital surgery, part of Jewish identity. I'm into that. This is really naturalizing that. But I'm also imagining Abraham before and after the circumcision. So he's hobnobbing with princes before and after the circumcision. So before, it's like, yeah, he's hanging out. He's a rich guy among rich guys. Afterward, does he tell people that he's different? Like me, he changed his name. I actually changed my name a few times. It was very embarrassing. So even like with trans people, they would say, oh, so-and-so. I'm like, no, now I'm somebody else. But, you know, Abraham has become Avraham. Who does he tell? Who does he come out to? Does he say, my identity, as a, you look at me and you think that I'm a man in the way that you understand what men are, but actually I'm not anymore. I've changed. I've changed in my flesh, and I've changed in my own relation to what it means to be a man, because my masculinity no longer is about being supreme in the world. It's about being subordinate to a greater authority. So I think Abraham had a transgendered experience, and if he came out to them, he would be othering himself. He would be making himself vulnerable and exposing himself to exile. Sarah, she gets pregnant in old age, and she has to publicly nurse because people don't believe that she actually was a real woman in those kinds of ways. Right? So she has to do this whole public weaning feast thing so that everybody can see. She has to expose herself to try to prove that she really is a woman in this sense, because the way that she's a woman defies natural categories. So to me, when I read the Torah, I actually see transgender experience all over the place. And I'm eager to bring that gift. Thank you.
It's time for questions, and you're going to take them, right?
Oh, yes.
Hi, thank you. I'm interested in the fact that you were teaching at an Orthodox women's college. And because Orthodoxy, it's not only a binary in terms of gender, but they're very strict gender roles. So, and there are many women, Orthodox women, who don't fit those roles, whether because they're gay or not married, or married and don't have children, or widowed, or whatever. And I'm wondering if you feel that there's an awareness of that among people today in Orthodoxy, and whether that cause them to be more accepted?
Well, that's a really great question. As I say, I don't know enough. Like, I haven't been able to grill people the way I'd like to be able to grill them about why they're accepting. I do know women, this will blow your minds, I know 22-year-olds who aren't married.
Wow.
They're not even dating. So in that world, that is a really strange thing. And these, you know, there can be students who are straight A's and they're heading to, you know, Harvard Med School, but they're considered a failure in terms of the Orthodox Jewish family value system. The thing about a modern Orthodox institution is that it's built to combine irreconcilably different worldviews and value systems. And I think that, yes, was it easier for people at a modern Orthodox institution to accept someone like me than at a not modern Orthodox institution? I totally think that that's true. I don't know the degree to which my students would say, oh, we don't fit normal categories either. I'm not sure that they would make that analogy. I'm not sure that they wouldn't. Nobody has ever said that to me. I do think that because I was transitioning toward them, this in general is easier, not always, but in general it's easier for people where you're moving toward them in your transition than people where you're moving away for a variety of reasons. But my students live in this homosocial world, and if you pass, if you give enough cues to register to them as a woman, I think it's awfully hard for them not to respond to you that way. They're just so trained to do that. So I actually, some students I think avoid me, but I don't know because they're too respectful to tell me. I don't get hate mail. I would take your class if you weren't some weird freak. Maybe somebody thinks that, but they have too much derech eretz to ever say it. So the students that I relate to, I feel much closer to, and they feel much closer to me because there isn't the gender gap. They feel very distant from men. They're not used to being with men, and relationships with men are stratified, and they're charged, and they have all kinds of issues. I think this is true in the secular world. I think that women's colleges that are secular, the reason that they're there is often women behave differently in all female communities than they do in mixed communities because of gender things. But so I think that play, you know, that's probably a bigger part of it. But that's a great point. Yes.
Yes. Where in the Jewish community do you feel most accepted, or just that you're not a stranger? And could you explain a little bit about what that is? Is there any place in the Jewish community that you feel that you are seen as an equal human being, or is in the community there is really no place yet that has gotten to the point where they can do that, where you can feel totally comfortable? Mm. Is there any place?
You know, that's a really great question, and it's a hard one for me to answer because, I don't have a community. So part of being a Jew is you don't only have this abstract covenant with the Jewish people, but you actually, have a shul. And you go to shivas, and you go to bar and bat mitzvahs endlessly, and, you know, that kind of stuff, right? You're a full member of a community. And although I've been sort of formally a member of a community for a couple of decades, I really am not a member of that community. And so, I haven't had that experience. And I feel that I didn't talk about this, but part of living as not a real person for so long is I feel like there are parts of me that are really underdeveloped. And my capacity to not feel like a stranger, my capacity to feel part of a community, is really underdeveloped. So it's hard for me to judge. So the truthful answer is really bizarre, and I'm uncomfortable with it, but it's true, which is that I tend to feel most part of communities when I'm doing these kinds of talks, where I feel like now I'm with a whole group of people, all of them know, I've come out to everybody at once, ideally they've read the book, you know, so they've had the whole manual on how weird I am, they're still here and talking to me. And we are thinking together about what it means to be Jews with a person like me. Now, actually, I don't want to live in a world where that's all I do. So that would be hard to sustain for more than an hour or two. But when I do these experiences, I often feel very blessed because I have that glimpse of, wow, this really is possible.
I think most shuls are hard to sustain for more than an hour or two.
Yes. Thank you so much for saying that. Yes. Yes.
Jumping off of that point, I was really wondering what practices you might have, be they Jewish, or maybe writing exercises that really work for you in your practice of tefillah.
Mm.
Or maybe there are particular prayers that really speak or resonate with you.
So I got to this partly because of being severely depressed for so long. So when for many people who transition in middle age, or by middle age I just mean when you've built a life around one gender and then you transition, the experience of transition is pretty much the experience of wrecking your life. So you make this bizarre trade-off. You get to be your true self, but you don't have anything else that goes along with the life. So for a long time, I like, hooray, I'm my true self. Where are my kids? Where's my home? Where's my job? Right? And I was pretty lucky in all of those respects. Many trans people are on the streets. They're unemployed. They're unemployable. Their families exile them. And, you know, I wasn't in those extreme situations. But I was in a profound position of grief as part of my rebirth process. And one of the things that everybody tells you when you're going through that kind of depression and grief is you need to think about gratitude. And it turns out that one of the things that was every Yom Kippur, when I was living as a guy, I would feel terrible for one reason. I saw Yom Kippur as the feast of self-hatred, so it's not a good use of Yom Kippur. But so that was going to make me feel terrible. But really, what I felt terrible about that was authentic spiritually was I wasn't grateful for existing. I really wasn't, and Yom Kippur I would realize, wait. Being Jewish and actually being in relation to God, which supposedly I am, it should be about gratitude, and I just can't do it. I'm not grateful. And so then I'm transitioning, and I'm living this miracle of becoming, and my prayers are literally answered, and I'm grieving and mourning, and I'm in tremendous pain. And I needed to learn to be grateful. So I started to, you know, I went through, you know, when I wake up, I immediately start thinking about the things that I'm grateful for from the preceding day. I want to start my day with that because I was born to kvetch. If I had been Bruce Springsteen, that's what my breakthrough album would be called. Power guitars and all. So that's my natural mode. So I need to make it a spiritual practice to start out by saying, you know, God, by the way, thank you so much. That was a really delicious dinner last night. I probably won't remember it once I've brushed my teeth. But right now, I want to make sure I do so that I have that gratitude built in. I also, every Yom Kippur, I feel like, you know, I really am still in this growing process. And I keep learning things. I keep learning about different ways that I need to grow. And I've realized that, not only is one day not enough, 10 days isn't enough for me. I tried the month of Elul thing. That actually isn't enough for me. It turns out that unless I work on this stuff every day, I'm hopelessly behind by the time Elul comes. I can't do it. So I try to start the day by remembering the key things that I learned on Yom Kippur that were ways that I needed to grow, ways that I'm not honest with myself, ways that I'm not the person that I wish I were. Because one of the gifts of being trans is, you know, a lot of people, my family, my children suffered, my ex suffered, a lot of people, and I suffered, a lot of us went through a lot of pain so that I could finally exist. I need to be, not only exist, I need to be the person, the best possible person that I can be. I'm in my 50s. I don't have all day for this. So that means I need to learn to imagine the best possible person that I can be, and I need to stop lying about the ways in which I am and am not. And for me, that's a huge amount of work. There are these parts of me that haven't grown in. There are these ways in which I was never really honest because I didn't feel like I was really there. So morally, I wasn't playing for keeps. Yeah, I was a little bit of a schmuck, but that's because I'm pretending to be a guy. I'm not really. If I were really myself, I'd be a really good person. I wouldn't have, you know, cut that moral corner. Well, this is it. This is the real me. So I would say that those are kind of the cornerstones. And I know they're not specifically very Jewish, but they do feel to me like they're the anchors of my Jewish life. Yes?
You spoke about how when you were younger you didn't feel like you fit into either part of the gender binary.
Yeah.
So, and obviously in your adulthood you chose to transition to the other side, the opposite end of the gender binary. So I'm wondering, one, if you ever still feel like you don't fit into the gender binary.
Yeah.
If you feel like if it had been a good option for you, or if society would have accepted it, if you would have chosen to transition to something that wasn't part of the gender binary.
Those are great questions. So the first one, really, the answer is yes. And one of the things that I've learned is, and the language of the book is, so I learned by writing the book, and now, and I've just kept learning. So I now say, I used to live as a man, and now I live as a woman, because I feel like those are historical facts. The question of essence is a tough one. It's a tough one because there are some women who are pretty angry at the idea that after 45 years of living as a guy, you can say, okay, now I'm a woman. They're like, oh, really? I think you've missed out on a few things. And they're right. I've missed out on a lot of things. So if one real definition of a woman is that you have a whole bunch of biological experiences and social experiences, and you really live and you do this, you grow up in certain ways, right? And by that definition of woman, I'm not and I can never be a woman. There's another definition of woman that has to do with this kind of essence thing, right? That there really is some sort of, like if you cut everyone open, you have a pink soul or a blue soul. And I'm not willing to undergo the operation. But I don't know. I mean, when I look in myself, like my ex used to say this when we would talk about this, she would say, well, you say you feel female. How the heck do you know what that feels like? Like, I don't know what it feels like. And I don't know if other women feel the way I do about feeling female. So what are you talking about? And what I'm talking about is what I would call gender identity, which is something you usually don't have to be very aware of unless it is somehow out of sync with either your body or the gender expression, the roles that your society gives you, or both. So if you look at the early feminist movement, there were a lot of women who thought a lot about their gender identity because their society, they knew they were women. They didn't have an issue with their bodies, but their society didn't provide any way of being a woman that had anything to do with what they felt was the reality of them. So that gave them something in common with me. That's a kind of a transgendered experience. So by that definition, I also fail. But I do know that I've always, as long as I remember, I've had a female gender identity, whatever that is, and I've always had a male body. And I've always had to live with the consequences of those things. You know, my body, I now do live as a woman. I present as a woman. But I also present as a transsexual. So I spend a lot of time being somebody who says, look at me, I'm a former man. Now relate to me as a woman. Right? And so that is obviously something other than if you were born, raised female, and you live as a woman, and you present yourself as a woman. In some way, that's pretty different than what I'm doing. So yeah, I always feel at odds with that. And I had somebody ask me, in this tone of exhaustion that told me she had this truly, she knew the heart of a stranger, I said, well, do you ever get to just call yourself a woman? And I actually, part of transition is this internal Egypt, this internal Mitzrayim. Even in the privacy of my own head, where it doesn't offend anyone else? Do I get to just say, I'm a woman? Do I give myself that freedom? And if I do, what do I mean by it? Because I don't mean the physical sense and I don't mean the historical sense. So I think what I mean is, when I say I'm a woman, I mean I'm really who I am. I'm an authentic human being. I have the courage to not make compromises on that. No matter how much it hurts, I'm going to be who I really am. That's what it means to be me, to be a woman. I'm going to be emotionally present and honest with people, even when that's really difficult for me, because as I understand, that's what I transitioned for. So that's not necessarily everybody's definition of being a woman, but that's what it is for me. Yes.
I was really moved by what you said about if we're not in someone's head, we're probably oppressing a lot of people in our communities. And as someone who plans to be a rabbi in a community, I'm wondering, I know you can't really figure what a totally open transgender community looks like, but specifically thinking about something like a women's seder,
yeah.
What are small things a community can do I guess I'm thinking about yourself in college because I work with college students. What would have made you feel open and welcome in a community as a that you weren't, you weren't a man and you wanted to, you were having a William Seder or a feminist community, language that I can think about.
Wow. Well, you know, one of the places that I've been that really works on this is Nehirim. So when they do women's retreats, they say on their promotional material, by women we mean anybody who considers themselves to be female, whatever you look like, whatever that means to you. So that's about as welcoming as it can be. But the facts on the ground are, there are a lot of women who are there and they've never met trans women before, and they certainly haven't met people who say, I'm a woman, who are 6 feet tall and have beards. Right? That's a new experience for them. And so if you're really an inclusive community, then you create safe spaces for everybody to have the necessary conversations and reflections that happen, rather than just saying, look, you either have the right feelings or you have the wrong feelings, because then you're including one group of people and you're making other people feel really uncomfortable. Right? So for really for all Jews, we're also for including Jews who are trans, and we're including Jews who are deeply uncomfortable with trans people. That's what the whole community is going to be. So how are we going to work on that? One of the models I do think you can use, and I haven't worked this out too much, but if you imagine doing an event on campus and it's a Jewish event, but you want to make sure that even those with the most tenuous, complicated, and fractured Jewish identity, the people who think they might convert but they've never been Jewish, the people who are not halachically Jewish but do identify as Jewish, what kind of language do you use to make them comfortable? And how do you structure the event so that they actually feel comfortable? Because if you say you're welcome, but then you pitch the event in a way that it's really only for this kind of Jew or that kind of Jew, then you end up defeating your own purpose. And then if you make them comfortable, how do you make the other kinds of Jews say, oh, I thought this was for real Jews. I see, now we have to explain everything, including to the Jews who've never seen a prayer book before. And right? So how do you create events that hold everybody together? Or do you stop trying to do that? And do you start seeing communities as these where everybody is free to create shifting coalitions based on different pieces of identity? So you're not just the transgender Jew, but sometimes you are. You go to the transgender Seder, but then at another time you go to the Jews for Tikkun Olam. And you're not there as a transgender person, you're just there because you're interested in Tikkun Olam, but the text study folks would never come. Right? So there are ways in which we do this when we, in the things that that are less charged, like in my Jewish community of Amherst, they couldn't call it anything more specific because then they would have lost people. So they do. They have the Tikkun Olam people, and they have the social justice people who are not the same, and then they have the prayer people. The prayer people who want to sing are not the same as the prayer people who don't want to sing. And then there are the people who skip the prayer, but they come for the text study because that's what they're about, right? And if you're our rabbi, you need to be able to create things that are for all of those people, and also events where different community, where different coalitions can get together and feel dealt with. I don't know if that's helpful, but
I want to make sure that we have time for you to purchase the book, get it signed, a little bit of final conversation. Thank you for very, very thoughtful questions, all in response to a thought-provoking and very thoughtful presentation. This is obviously an important conversation, and we encourage you to continue with the conversation. So thank you all for coming. The book is $20. Cash is good. If you've got a check, just pay it to the order of the library of JTS. If you want to increase the amount on the check to give a donation to the library, that's fine too. And thank you for coming.
Thank you.
I'm going to send you a gushy email tomorrow because that was just utterly spectacular.
I'm a million. But before I leave,